And now, join Kevin Hart as he dives into the minds of some of the world's funniest comedians. This is Comedy Gold Mines with Kevin Hart.
Welcome, world. Welcome to an all-new episode of Comedy Gold Mines, where we do what? Yes. Yes, the answer is correct, that I know that you know to say, which is get into the minds of amazing comedians. And oh my God, what amazing minds they are. And today's episode will be no different. Legend. You can't say those words if you don't mean it. So there has to be a feeling, a strong sense of not just belief, but one of fucking joy when I use it, especially when I'm referring to those that share the passion for the craft that I am in. Ladies and gentlemen, Eddie Griffin is on the goddamn show.
What's up, y'all? Hey, Kevin, what's going on, man?
Man, brother, when I tell you, I'm happy as hell to talk to you because I know the stories, the journey. It's not just interesting. I've yet to hear it through your goddamn, through your words, through your vision, man. And talking like this to you is something that I'm going to enjoy. I know it. For my listeners, man, you're from Kansas City, right?
Yep, Kansas City, Missouri.
Kansas City, Missouri. Eddie, how long have you been doing comedy? True to the game.
Shit, about 38 to 39 years, almost 40 years.
Almost 40 fucking years, man. 40th anniversary is coming up. For that, what will you do? Is there a big celebration? Is there something in mind?
Hopefully I will be on stage somewhere the day that it goes down because, you know, I'm still in love with the craft, man. So, you know.
Still on the road too.
Yeah.
Still on the road.
Yes.
You were doing the tour and this is just, you know, V coming off my knowledge because I follow you guys. It was the
Comedy Get Down tour with me, George Lopez, DL, and Cedric.
Yes, you guys did that.
And the late great Charlie Murphy.
Rest in peace. How many rounds did you guys do though? Because that tour, you guys had that out for a minute, right?
We did about 5 years.
Five fucking years. Whose idea was it to put it together?
I think it was a collective idea. We were doing a tribute show to Richard Pryor in Peoria, Illinois to raise money for that statue.
Yep.
So we all went out drinking after the show and they said, yeah, and George said, you want to take it on tour? And Cedric said, favorite nations. That's how it happened.
Get out of here. That fast.
Yeah, that fast.
And how did you guys, how did that group basically, like the decision to raise money for the statue, was that a collective idea as well? Or did somebody reach out to y'all? How did that come about?
Richard Pryor's wife reached out to me.
Okay.
And I didn't know who else was on the show or nothing, you know. And we got there, you know, comedians get together, we get the vibe.
I mean, look, it's the best setting in the world. A room of funny, especially with some connective tissue, people that get along. You know, those nights can go for fucking days. They turn into days of just banter.
It turned into 5 years.
Five fucking years, man. But it's such a great group, right? Like it's a great piece of synergy through you all because none of you are the same. None of you have the same styles. Everybody has a different approach to that craft. So I think that's why you guys had the success that you had and for the duration that you fucking had of that. You being on stage now, are you out now solo or are you out with somebody now?
I got a residency here in Las Vegas. I moved to Las Vegas. I had a residency out here at the Sahara for 14 years.
Get the fuck out of here. That's so strong, man.
Yeah, 14 years. I do Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, sometimes Thursdays. And then I still travel on the weekends.
Give me the difference in the world of residency in Vegas compared to the actual road. Although you're doing both, what's the difference in the two for those comics that may just want to know? How would you explain the difference?
Vegas, you're getting a collection of the world in your audience. I mean, I got motherfuckers from Egypt, Bangladesh, Africa, China. Everybody's in the motherfucking crowd. So, you got to have a world view with your humor. When you're on the road, you know, that crowd is from Iowa.
Uh-huh.
So you better zero in on the Iowa sensibility. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know this. You know, if you're in Kansas City, you know, Kansas City got a certain sensibility. You know, New York's got a certain sensibility.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? So yeah, that's the biggest difference to me.
You got a universal side of it in Vegas. You're getting a plethora of so many that are coming to this fucking to this goddamn city, and being that that's the case, you want to be universal. Here's the big question, right? And I've always, you know, I've thought about this myself because, you know, it is now becoming something that's of interest, right? Like when you get to a certain point in your career, that wear and tear of bouncing around, you know, it's like you want to do it because you love it, but how often do you want to jump on the plane? How often, you know, do you want to get up in the morning, get the bags together, be at a different hotel, et cetera, et cetera? So with Vegas presents is so fucking dope because there's some stability while you still get to do the thing that you love. My question for you is it ever a moment where it's a like where it's a Groundhog Day-ish feel of the building, the fucking hotel, you know, walking in the same place, doing that same stage, or do you find that new energy every single time?
Oh, I find that new energy every single time because every audience is different.
Yeah.
Every motherfucking audience is different. And, you know, I've never written a joke. Everything you ever seen me do is off the top of the dome. I'm naturally retarded. So I feed off of the audience. You know what I mean? I have set pieces that I do. You know what I mean? I have set pieces that I get some go-to shit. But other than that, I'm just feeding. And my brain works in pictures. So, you know, I could look at some news and my brain says, fill in the blanks and what's missing. You know what I mean? And then that's where the humor comes from. And then I work the material out on his feet.
That's pretty insane, man. It's insane that you say that. I mean, look, that's something that I'm quite sure all comics wish they could tap into. You know, the ability to go off the cuff, be off the cuff, and like you referred to it, off the dome. You know, that's where I think the best flourish, right? They flourish being on their feet and being able to react.
Oh man, I don't act like you don't do it. I just seen you do it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. You all do it, but you gotta, you know, when you hear somebody speak of it. It's just it's a dope ass thing to know, like within the craft, there's the ability that some have to fucking go in and out on the fly. Right. And you not just doing it and have done it for so many years. Like what I want to do now, man, I want to give you flowers, not just because of your success, but because of all the tears of success that you fucking touched, right? And I want to go back now to Eddie Griffin, and I want to go to the earlier days of Eddie Griffin, the comic, fucking coming on the scene, the specials, the fucking, you know, the hat, the flair. Like, there was so much pizzazz that you had about you. Your introduction to Hollywood, right? You are one of the few that had a TV show. You had a TV show, and you had seasons on a TV show. Talk to me about the beginning stages of that, right? Your transition from this comic star that's now on the rise and now being accepted by the powers to be in Hollywood. What was that time like for you?
Ooh, that was a strange time in my life because I really did not want a TV show at all.
Okay.
Because I felt that it would constrict me. You know, I like going raw dog to the cuff. You know,
yeah.
I like to say my niggas, my motherfucker, all my shit.
Yeah, yeah.
And TV felt constricting. But the way it came about, I was doing a show at the House of Blues across the street from the Comedy Store.
Okay.
And I had a band at the time. You know, I don't know if you know, I play instruments and, you know, I do music also. So I had a band. So George Jackson and Doug McHenry was managing me at the time. Those are the two biggest black producers in Hollywood at the time. They did all the, you know, Fridays and all that shit. No, not Fridays. Which one they did? The researcher. They did some movies. My memory's fucked up. So anyway, they did that one with Wesley Snipes in it.
Okay. Okay.
You know that.
You talking about his big one? Are you talking about the
big one? Yeah, the big one. New Jack City.
Okay.
And Jason's leg. So that's them.
Okay.
So anyway, I did the show. I had the band. I did an hour of stand-up, and then I did an hour with the band. So Eric Tannenbaum, who was running Sony Pictures at the time, was in the audience. So he hit George up. Yeah, I'd like to get his kid a TV show. So I met with him the next day. And then they said, but you don't have a Q factor. I'm like, what the fuck is a Q factor? I didn't even know what the fuck a Q factor was. Uh-huh. I mean, somebody asked the question, would they know who the fuck he is? I uh-huh. said, I guess not, motherfucker. So then they said, you got to get somebody with a Q factor. So I was at William Morris Agency, right?
Okay.
So they was like, me and Tupac. I'm like, nigga, that show will be canceled after two episodes. You can't have two volatile niggas on the show. So then they said Malcolm Jamal won. I said, you talking about Theo?
Yeah.
I said, yeah, that's a good look. So Theo came in about a week later. We sat in the William Morris office, him, his manager, all our agents and shit. So I pulled Theo to the side. I said, fuck all these managers, fuck all these agents. Let's me and you go have a couple of drinks and powwow. So we went and had some drinks. As my grandfather told me, if a motherfucker won't drink with you, you can't trust him.
Okay.
Needless to say, Malcolm can put him down. That motherfucker drunk about seven martinis.
Yeah. Yes,
y'all had a good time. Patron, I said, oh, he got some nigga in him. He got some nigga in him. And that's how the show started.
That was your test. That was your test right there.
Yeah.
A great combination just because you wouldn't expect it, right? And give me, for my listeners, man, he's talking about a show. It's called Malcolm and Eddie. And, you know, this is Eddie Griffin's TV show. Was getting it lasted for quite some time. A very, very successful show. And the network at that time, was that UPN?
Yeah. It was on You Pick a Nigga.
Yeah, You Pick a Nigga.
Yeah, You Pick a Nigga. That's what UPN, You Pick a Nigga. They had short ones, fat ones, skinny ones, old ones, young ones, yeah.
The crazy thing about UPN, man, when you think about it, like, it's no longer here today. But when you look at the lineup of television that presented itself on that network, I mean, it was strong when you talk about people of color, right? Like, we had a real presence on TV in a place where, you know, outside of BET, which still stands today, but a place where you can go.
Oh yeah, they love to use us to build networks on. Once the network's built, then they switch back to the business as usual.
Yes, pure. Then it's okay. Well, we've got to a place where we have the audiences.
Yes.
And now
yes.
We go and we switch to the regularly scheduled program that we want it to be.
It's
one of the coldest moves that you'll see in Hollywood.
Yeah, they playing chess, not checkers.
Absolutely. It's the long game.
Yeah.
You do this show, you and Malcolm have success, the show ends up going away. A lot of times, you know, for actors, actresses, when this type of situation presents itself, well, it's catastrophic, right? Some fucking fall. There is no life after. Oh my God, I'm ruined. What's going to happen to me now? What was life for you like after that time?
It was a breath of fresh air.
Okay.
Yeah, it ended at the right time.
Okay. What do you mean by that?
I think it had ran its course, you know, because there's only so long two grown men gonna live in the same damn apartment.
Yeah.
When we're successful. I had a successful tow truck business. He had a successful bar business. Why the fuck are we still in the same apartment?
Why are we still roommates?
So it had ran its course because, you know, they stopped running out of stories.
Yeah. Yeah.
So then they started rehashing stories from season one and put a new dress on it and shit. So no. So it had ran its course. But, you know, me and Malcolm, we still cool. We still tight to this day.
That's
so
dope.
You know.
That's dope as hell.
Yeah, it's beautiful. You know, it becomes a family.
Absolutely. I mean, we spend that time.
You know, I was his retarded big brother. And he was my smart little brother.
So the TV show, it elevates the world of comedy for you. I mean, now, you know, you got more eyeballs on you. You get back out there, you're back on the road. But now let's talk movies. The fucking world of movies comes. Until this day, I will stand on a podium and I will speak passionately about Undercover Brother. I will, when I tell you, the best cold crack when it comes to that parody-like satire film that you ground. This character was so dope because you grounded it. You grounded it with performance. The writing was fucking grounded and you believed it. Where the jokes were supposed to be, they were. It just did not miss, man. You gotta talk to me about how Undercover Brother came about. Like, what was the origin of how this thing came together?
Well, Eddie Murphy pretty much nailed that role for me.
Okay.
Universal had the script and they were thinking about, you know, doing a movie, and they asked Eddie if he would do it. He's like, oh no, this ain't me.
Yeah.
This is Eddie Griffin. And I came in. Eddie Murphy did that.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. He said, this ain't me. This is Eddie Griffin. So I went in, I met with the producers and nailed the audition, you know, because, you know, I'm just cool like that. In order to play Undercover Brother, you just got to be naturally just a cool, calm, collected type dude, you know.
Eddie, it was so good because it can go the other way. If you yes. try to go, if you try to overdo it, it's not yeah. going to be.
It would sink.
Yes. 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 Like you and I'm telling you, man, you can't imagine anybody else in the part after seeing you in the part, right? You said Eddie's the one that did that. What was your and Eddie's relationship like? Were y'all cool?
Yeah, we was always cool, man. When I was working out at the Comedy Store the first years, when I first got to town, and Eddie would come down and check me out. He's like, hey, I remember one night he told me, nigga, you ready for the world, nigga. You ready for the damn world. And,
wow.
And we took me out to eat sushi. That's the first time I ever had raw fish. Uh-huh. And we left from the Comedy Store. We went across the street, that sushi on Sunset. So we sitting there and I said, all right, we're going to eat. And they start bringing out these little tiny pieces of raw fish. I'm like, I said, when they going to cook it? And Eddie started cracking up. Yeah. He answered, when they going to cook it? I said, I ain't eating this shit. He said, just try it. And nigga, I tried some unagi. That's that eel shit and some yellowtail with jalapeno. I've been hooked on sushi ever since.
Ever since Eddie Murphy introduced it to you, you never looked back afterwards.
Yeah.
What sparked the move to LA? Was that just a random thing?
No, I was a big fish in a small pond. I was doing stand-up back in KC, and I had my own local TV show, you know, the Eddie Griffin talk show, nigga. And my mama said, all right, nigga, you a big fish in a small pond. Why don't you go to one of the coasts and see if you a whale in the ocean?
Damn.
And that, you know, mom, she got a way of putting shit, nigga. Yeah, she like, no, look,
as,
nigga.
That's as clear as day to me. I understand yeah. exactly what it means.
So I jumped on the Greyhound hemorrhoid bus ride. Because, I couldn't afford no plane ticket. But, nigga, I took the hemorrhoid bus ride, and they stopped at every gas station.
I was going to say, nigga, would it take you 2 weeks to get there? How long did it take?
Yeah, it took about 2.5 weeks. I ain't bullshitting. 2.5 weeks, nigga. I almost stayed in Colorado Springs. So I finally made it out there, and I was homeless for like a month.
Really?
When I first got out there, you know, because I was staying out in Compton with my Uncle Bucky, but, you know, he had went to the penitentiary, and, you know, it was a lot of drugs being dealt out the house. They get a drive-by on the crib when I was inside. We were watching Eddie Murphy Delirious at the time, and they just sprayed it down. Everybody laying on the floor, still watching Eddie get down. And I got up, I said, I can't live like this, y'all. So I packed my bag, and I went downtown to the shelter. And then after a month, I finally got two jobs. I was working at All American Chicken, All American Pizzeria at the Bonaventure Hotel. And I was delivering pizzas, and I was doing security at the hotel that I was staying at. So then I finally seen this drama log, and it said the Comedy Store. I never heard the Comedy Store because it was never on TV back home in Kansas City. I had no clue that the shit even existed or the improv. So I said, oh, the Comedy Store. So I got on the bus, went to Hollywood. And I called the Comedy Store. I said, yeah, this is Eddie Griffin. I'd like to showcase for the owner, Missy Shore. They like, well, he had that played in 3 major clubs around the country. I said, oh, really? Hung the phone up, called back 10 minutes later, playing like I'm my manager. Hello, this is Eddie Griffin's manager, and he's performed. I'm reading out the drama law. He's performed at the Funny Bone. He's performed at the Improv. Yes, yes, yes. He's a wonderful, wonderful talent. You should check him out this evening. So they gave me an audition at 7:30. So I'm just hanging out. 7:30 came along. I went up, did 5 minutes, blew the spot up. And Mitzi, you remember how Mitzi used to talk?
Absolutely.
And she said, oh my God, you got more time in your pinky than anybody seen in 10 years. You want to work for me? So I said, can somebody translate? I can't understand what the fuck she's saying. So the manager said, I think she said, would you like to work for her? I said, hell yeah, I want to work for her. Tell her I got a problem. I'm homeless. And wow. Mitzi took me off the streets, put me up in Crest Hill. And that's how the whole shit kicked off.
Wow. I mean, this is why I do the podcast, man. I swear to you, this is exactly why. I mean, you don't... people really have no idea of how fucking crazy the road and journey is for the fucking comedian.
Man, I got to give you your flowers. That piece that you did on Netflix, bruh.
Thank you, man. True story. Bruh. Thank you. Thank you.
You did an Oscar-worthy performance. When you choked out that Italian dude, nigga, I said, this motherfucker's crazy. Nigga. And then you shot your brother at the end, nigga, dropped the gun and walked like a soldier should. I said, nigga, bravo, bravo, bravo.
I appreciate it, man. Means the world coming from you, dude. I'm a fan. I'm a student of comedy, but I'm a bigger fan, man. And you know, look, when you see the examples of, you know, the pioneers 30, 35 years, like you said, 40 years, and still getting on that stage, still slinging jokes, but still loving the craft. You know, those are reasons for me to smile. That shit motivates me. And I can only hope that I'm at the same space and condition when I get to a certain age. As you guys, like, and you look good. Like,
no, well, thank you.
You don't look like life is kicking your ass, man. You look good. You look
No,
happy.
It's not. No, the way I live my life, nigga, is let the positive shit stay in and fill your spirit up. Let the negative shit go in one ear and completely out the other. You should not let anybody get any airtime in your mind with negative bullshit.
It's huge. It's huge. It's the right mindset. When you speak that way, though, of course, it comes from dealing with the negative shit and possibly handling it wrong. Did you go through a whirlwind where you felt like the negative was taking over or?
Oh, hell yeah, man. Yeah, that's par for the course.
Yeah.
You know, that I'm sure you already went through that early on. You know what I'm saying? Which is why your career, you're doing everything right, my brother.
Thank you, man. Thank
everything
you.
Right.
Thank you,
because
man.
You done already went and dealt with that shit. Mm-hmm. Me, fame was thrust on me so early, nigga. And nigga, I had to go through this shit while I'm famous, nigga. Yeah. And it did. I lost my mind.
Yeah. Give me an example of your worst moment where you're like, I fucking checked out for a minute. I truly lost it for a minute.
Mm. I was in South Africa. I was shooting this movie called Blast.
Mm-hmm.
And we went out clubbing. And these Madagascarian dudes, I didn't know the Madagascarians ran the drug trade over there.
Mm-hmm.
So I had the dumbest motherfucker security guard in history. He liked to do one-arm push-ups in front of everybody, trying to test their skills. And he always like, what's your style? What's your style? So the Madagascar showed him the style by pulling a pistol out on this motherfucker. So, nigga, I'm drunk, high out my motherfucking mind. And I charged the motherfucker with the pistol. This is why I got stitches right here. That motherfucker hit me in the head.
Wow.
With a 4.5.
Wow.
But he dropped the gun because I thought he was trying to aim at my baby brother's chest. And you know, I wasn't about to lose another brother because, you know, my mother, she got two kids left, me and my baby brother. If he show up dead, I'm dead anyway. So I might as well just charge the motherfucker with the gun.
Wow. You come from a family of how many?
Six.
Six of y'all.
Yeah. My mother has lost four.
R.I.P. to all those that were lost. Younger in your life, but what part? What part of your life?
My sister, she was the oldest. Mm-hmm. And she died of breast cancer, 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So, and my oldest brother, his name was Luther. He was born a set of triplets. And my mother lost two of them, one right after they were born and one a week after they were born. So Luther was a survivor.
Damn.
And so now it's just me and my baby brother.
And you know, that relationship, I can hear just from what you just said, like my mom was about to lose another one, right? I can only imagine that you guys are extremely close. What role has he played in your world of success and growth? How close has he been to your success?
My baby brother?
Mm-hmm.
Man, can't do it without him.
That's dope.
Can't do it without him.
That's dope as hell. Was it just mom or was it mom and dad?
It was just mom. My dad, he was a sperm donor.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, he dropped some nut off and left.
And got up out of there. And your relationship with your mom, tough as hell, strong ass woman.
Oh yeah, she's strong. She's strong. She raised all of us, nigga, by herself. You know. I moved her out here to Las Vegas to keep her close.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So you know, she ain't going to no home ever.
Mm-hmm.
If she feel like she's slowing down, because she ain't slowed down yet. Mama get up at 5 o'clock every morning.
Still.
Jump in the car and ride out.
Still.
Still.
Wow. Yeah. Right now, you know, what's the world of now for you, right? We know you're in Vegas. We know that you're in a residency in Vegas, but you know, the side of living that helps keeps you at peace. What are you doing? What's the other hobby? Something else is happening because you're so fucking, you're so poised, you're so zen, just in comfort. I can just see like there's a nice sense of happy to you. So what are the other things outside of the business?
It's my beautiful wife, man. I got a beautiful wife. Her name is Cole Griffin.
Mm-hmm.
She's Korean.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't care what the race is. She's dope as fuck. It's my two daughters, Leah and Naomi. Leah's just got accepted to Syracuse College.
Well, congratulations, man.
Naomi's brilliant, brilliant. There's my son, Michael, whose hands is, I think I got a welterweight champion.
Ooh, boxing.
Yeah. His hands is nice. Yeah.
How long has he been boxing?
He's been boxing for 6 years. He's only 12.
That's big.
Yeah, 12. And he's That's a southpaw. Big. He's a southpaw.
How did he get into boxing? Just stumbled on it?
I put all my kids into boxing. You know, that self-defense is self-confidence.
I've heard that you got hands.
You know.
I've heard that from the shoulders, you're where you're supposed to be. The word on the street is you and Martin are two comics that were known to throw some hands, you know, correctly, the right way. That's word on the street.
But yeah, you know, growing up without a father, you know, I had to box.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Okay.
Because, you know, I've always been small in stature. You know, when you small, we can't intimidate nobody.
Yeah.
This is why most big motherfuckers cannot fight, because they've been intimidating their way through life. We can't do that. We have to really toss them. So, yeah, you know, but that aside, my son, Michael, nigga, I think I got a welterweight champion. And then there's...
That's strong.
My youngest son, Miko, me and Cole's first.
Okay, so you got four kids total.
Yeah, no, I got 11 children altogether.
11, good shit.
Yes, I got eight Fuck boys, you. Three girls.
Eight boys, three.
These
girls.
These are the ones that are living here with me. The rest of them are grown.
Okay, okay.
You know, that's my first crop. This is my new crop of kids.
Now, what's the world of connective tissue with the crop? Are you together? Do you get your time where they all come to dad?
Oh yeah, no. All my kids, all of them have spent time with daddy.
That's dope, man. That's fucking dope.
Because, you know, not growing up with a father, I made a promise to myself. I'ma always be the father that I always wanted.
I love it. I love it. I love that, you know, not only, I love that you're celebrating it, right? Like that, first of all, that's a lot of kids, all right? It's a lot of goddamn kids, but they get the dad, they see dad, they definitely are love dad. They love dad. That's what you want people.
Dad loves
that's
him.
Dope, man. Good for you.
Anybody know me? I'm all about my kids. Don't come fucking with me about my kids. I'll bring it to you.
I want to get back to your son boxing for a second, man. You said you put him in it. Where right now? Is it is it is it competition? What do you have him in? Like when you say you feel like you got that on your hands, what's he competing in right now? He's bad. He's a bad man. See,
No. I'm gonna keep it private for right now, okay, because you know he's young. He's young.
Got you. Got
you. So you know, but yeah, he's competing and he's whooping ass.
Got you.
But yeah, you know, I don't want to put the
cart. I get it. I'm picking up what you just laid down. Absolutely.
You know me. You know, I chose to be famous. My kids have not yet chose to be famous, yeah. But when they do, I'll tell you everything.
Absolutely. You're being reserved for a good reason about it. Has your fame affected any of them at any point? Did it ever present itself to be too much for you or your family?
Oh, my youngest daughter, she when we go out to dinner now, my youngest daughter is Naomi. She does security better than security.
Okay.
Now, you know, when you out at dinner, I'm sure you've been through this with your family. And, you know, the crazy fan, they damn near come and sit at the table with you. You know what I mean? Hey, yeah. Eddie, hey. My daughter like, excuse me.
He's eating.
Y'all get him all the time. It's my time.
Yeah.
If you'll excuse yourself. And how they gonna get mad at a little girl telling them that?
They can't.
They be like, oh, my bad. All right, Ed, I just want to let you know that I love you. All right, cool. So I try to take her everywhere with me because she does a hell of a job at security. Security job is to diffuse a situation, not jumpstart a situation as my old security with the one-arm push-up crazy motherfucker did.
Crazy motherfucker. You go through that period where the people that you have with you on the road, man, it's very hard to manage these personalities. So I'm laughing because when you go, this motherfucker, goddamn it, man, when I tell you so many problems came from this goddamn jacket, like I relate because I too have.
It takes a minute to get quality security because one thing I learned, you never hire karate motherfuckers to do security. They always going to start some shit to try to prove they worth. And then they end up getting knocked the fuck out. Now you end up having to do security for security.
Yeah, you don't want a karate man. No. You don't want a karate man ever.
No karate, ever. No kung fu, none of that shit.
Ever.
No.
Let's talk about the state of comedy today. You know, comedy, just where it is in general, man. What do you feel? How do you feel about the new generation of comedy? You know, I mean, now, like you said, you're a pioneer. You're a fucking legend. Looking at these younger comics come up, looking at the success of the new, looking at how it's changing, looking at what the internet is today. You know, is this something that you're blown away by? Are you supportive? Is it like, what the fuck is happening? This generation is. What's your feeling on the now in comedy?
Man, I think it's beautiful. These kids have stretched the boundaries where comedy can go.
Absolutely.
You know, I'm not one of them old school motherfuckers hating anything new, nigga. I love them 85 South boys, nigga. They doing the damn very thing.
DC Young, they Fly, damn, Carlos, man. And Chico. Yeah. Very funny guys, man.
Yeah, they hot. So I'm trying to get involved in it. You know, I've just put together my first podcast.
Good shit, man.
And I'm gonna try to jump into the realm, you know, and see what my creative juices can add to this equation.
Why not? Why not?
You know what I mean?
Look, it's the when you talk about being creative, it's always exercising that muscle that we love to use in the first place, man. You know, you doing anything when you're in position to talk and be personable is a fucking great thing. There is no bad to it. So putting a microphone in front of your face, you're only going to get the side of good. And you get to see what's working, right? You see what all of these this younger generation has basically put in front of us and showed us that works. So why not do it? You know, all you got to do is just make sure it's that thing that you're going to fucking love and be happy with. That's what this is.
Yeah.
I love the podcast because I just get to talk to people that I truly embrace. Like, for me, there's nothing better. There's nothing better. That's and right. I get to learn more. I mean, you telling me you were fucking homeless. You telling me that Mitzi's the one that got you the goddamn place when you said that you were homeless. I mean, the world in which Malcolm and Eddie started and you know, the things that you held on to, the little life nuggets that mom told you, you know, that your uncle told you, you know, when you, I listen, this the shit like that is entertaining to me. I want to go back now to just the people that were in your class. When you started, who was in your class, right? Like, what were the comics that you feel shared the same timeline in which you were fucking banging out the goddamn bando with your fucking success? Who else was around at that time?
Robin Harris,
mm-hmm.
Steve Harvey, Cedric the Entertainer, Martin,
it's insane.
Jamie Foxx.
It's insane.
You know, Bernie Mac.
How does that make you feel though now when you look back and you look at all of those that were around then that now share that stardom, right? Mm-hmm. That share that fucking we made it. Is it a little mind blowing or surreal to you?
No, man. You know, I would have never left Kansas City unless I knew that I could do it. You know what I mean? I mean, it's mind baggling in the sense that, damn, we all hit. You know what I mean? Everybody from my class hit. Nigga, there was nobody in my motherfucking class that was lame. Because we had all been doing stand-up for 10, 15 years before we hit. You know what I mean? Before we hit big, you know what I mean? So we had put the work in. Before Def Jam came, none of us was on motherfucker to Tonight Show. Remember back in the days, back in the 70s, when Richard and all of them was hitting, nigga, you had to do a Tonight Show set in order to hit.
Yeah.
But that wasn't, we didn't have that opportunity because it was too many of us niggas. And Hollywood was only one nigga at a time. Now, God damn it, we're going to go from Richard to Eddie Murphy and no more niggas. But nigga, we came out fine, nigga. They had to say, God damn it, these niggas is good.
Where they coming from? So, nigga, so many.
Martin hit me up. Nigga, Martin is a genius. I had my first half hour HBO special, right? And nigga, I was at the Comedy Store one night. Martin came over, was like, hey, Ed, I got this new show, Def Jam. Won't you come and do it? I'm like, nigga, I already got a half hour. So I'm gonna do 5 minutes on Def Jam 4. He like, you silly motherfucker. Don't nobody know who you is. You do 5 minutes on Def Jam, blow the spot up, they gonna be waiting to see your special. I said, this nigga's a genius. So I flew to New York, nigga. Now, remember the outfit that I had on Def Jam?
Hell yeah.
I had on some blue suede boots.
Yes.
Some Chicago Bulls sweats and a camouflage jacket and a big old motherfucking Jamaican hat.
The big hat.
Now, motherfuckers like, why the fuck did he wear that? Because New York, everybody said New York is a tough crowd. Like, they boo motherfuckers. I said, all right, cook. I said, I'm going to come out looking like the strangest nigga on earth. And before they knew what hit them, the jokes is lighting them up.
Yeah, yeah.
Because when I walked out on stage, everybody like, what kind of nigga is this? And it's too late, nigga. I'm already in there.
Yeah, yeah. I got your attention, but now I'm going to hit you with this performance. You're going to get these jokes now. And you're not going to forget me. Mm-mm. You're not going to forget me. And you're going to remember this name when I walk off
the
stage.
When I did Michael Jackson on crack, nigga, that was the end.
It was it. It was over. Yeah. What do you mean? Def Comedy Jam All-Stars, Def Comedy Jam Classic, Def Comedy Jam History. Mm-hmm. When you talk about your class, you talk about all of those individuals. I want to my listeners, I mean, goddamn, man, you know, you look back at your surroundings, you're a product of what you're around. Your environment plays a major role. That environment breeded nothing
but greatness.
Fucking successful.
Because iron sharpens iron, nigga. Iron sharpens iron. Nigga, you going on stage after any one of them motherfuckers at the Comedy Store or the Comedy Act Theater, nigga, you like, I better bring my A game.
Wow.
And that's wow. Every night you got to bring your A game. And then you have the class before us popping in.
Wow.
You know what I mean? You got an Eddie Murphy popping in. I had to follow Eddie Murphy one night. And nigga, they said Eddie Murphy. Then they said Eddie Griffin. And they like, who the fuck is this? And nigga, I tore into that ass and got a standing ovation.
I mean, these are the defining moments, right?
Yeah.
Who is your, give me your top three.
My top three?
Top three. Yeah.
Richard Pryor.
Mm-hmm.
George Carlin.
Oh, good one. Good one.
And Eddie Murphy.
Eddie Murphy. I love it.
Mm-hmm.
I love it. Strong. Mm-hmm. I like you had Carlin in there too, you know?
Hell yeah. Carlin was a wordsmith.
Yeah. Smart.
That motherfucker was a wordsmith. He could twist a word three times a Sunday.
Very smart.
Yes.
Very, very, very smart.
He was well read, as they say.
Yes. Yes. He picked up a couple papers in his time.
Yes.
He read.
Yes.
Read and figured out some shit. That's exactly what he did. Right now, man, is there any more wants for you in the business? Is there anything that you feel you want to do that you haven't done?
Yeah, there's an Oscar in my future.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's gonna be a Oscar Robinson. So I'm gonna have a couple of hot dogs after this. I'd like to do a heavy, heavy, heavy dramatic piece. And I'm not, mm-hmm. you know, looking for no award, but I just really want to delve into that side of acting real strong. So, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. that's what
I've
been
comics,
working
I feel
on.
Like it's the, that's, I mean, it's a layup for comics. I feel like, you know, we all have that. We all got that ability to turn it on and off when it comes into acting, when it comes into portraying something, you know, because we've dealt with so much shit. So, you know, the comedy is the hard part. That's the hard part. The going serious, that's the easy part. So, you know, when you say that, I get it instantly.
So, I'm ready for some of that easy work.
Yeah, we have too much to pull from, too many reasons of why. You know, man, I love that when I referred to you as you look good. I said you just look happy. Like there's something going on. And the first thing you said is my wife, you know, my wife, my family. It was all based off of, you know, that thing around.
Yes, you gotta have a proper core, man. If your core is weak, then you're gonna be weak.
Yeah. How long have you been married?
9 years.
9 years, man. Good shit. Congrats.
Yeah.
An example of what happiness is and what it can be.
Mm-hmm.
We need more like you. We need more out there that are living in bliss just because they have ground to stand on and someone to share that ground with. I think that's dope as fuck. I gotta go into a couple more questions, man, but you're answering so many. It's just, I love the comedy. I love the comedy fucking class reference that you came up with. Is there anybody in stand-up comedy that you, like, I can say from back then, right, when we talk about all that you were around, was there anybody in your younger years that you tried to pattern yourself after? How did you come up with, like, your style, right? Like, before it was honed in yours, was there a world of doing what I see and I'm trying to be something else other than me.
Shit, I was trying to be Mudbone.
Okay.
Mudbone is where most of my early material, I don't have to do is just do that character, and that character just wrote material.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? So, I was trying to be Mudbone, one of Rich's characters.
Yeah, I was about to say for the audience, Mudbone is a character that Richard referred to in stand-up.
I remember back in 1703, I was alive then. A lot of motherfuckers don't believe it, but I was.
God damn.
See, because 1703, that's when the government tried to kill all the niggas, but the niggas was too fast. They had tennis shoes before tennis shoes was made.
How did you get out of that? How did you, what is it that got you out of that and made you say you can be Eddie?
It was a night in Kansas City, Missouri. I was I had this comedy room because the first night I went on stage, I got banned. They said I was too blue. I didn't even know what the fuck blue meant. But, you know, I was too blue and I got banned the first night I ever did stand up. But I got a standing ovation after doing 45 minutes off the top of the dome. So I was hooked right then and then.
Wow.
So I've been opportunity and spirit. I went down to 18th and Vine where the jazz clubs are. And I asked them, I said, what's your slow night? They said, Tuesday. I said, okay, how about if I do comedy down here on Tuesday? I said, I don't see nobody here. So if I bring two people, y'all win it. So anyway, shit blew up, da da da. So I was on stage one night doing the Mudbone shit, da da da. And somebody in the audience said, hey, nigga, do you?
Ooh.
You understand me? So the challenge was put forth. That's why audiences are key to stand up. That's why stand up is the roughest art form you ever want to be in because it's mental combat with the audience at times. So motherfucker said, do you? And I had to stop and look at this motherfucker. And you know, I got a healthy ego. So I said, well then, I'm doing me now, son of a bitch. And that's how it started.
That's how it started.
And then the jokes started flowing through my voice. And then I'm hearing laughter because I'm being me.
Mm-hmm.
It was light over bulb. After that.
Light bulb moment. Well, I'm gonna tell you it was over. This particular episode on this podcast, but I'm gonna tell you what you have been doing. And that's you, right? You don't get the fucking 40 years. You don't get the 38 going on 40 years without doing you. My friend, I will say, you know, it's because of the doors that you've kicked open, because of the ground that you have broken, that people like myself and so many others are able to do this at the level that we do it at. We don't get here without your road work, man. And, you know, another reason for this podcast is to give the ones flowers that deserve it. And you give it to them while they're here. And if you're not educated on Eddie Griffin and his specials, man, do yourself a favor. Go look up Eddie Griffin. Go look up his HBO half hour. Go look up Eddie Griffin on Def Comedy Jam. Go look at the world of television. Go look at the world of film when Eddie was starring in movies. And like I said, Undercover Brother, which is one of my favorite movies of all time. But go look at the trajectory. And what I want people to understand, he said it, you know, there's a world where only two black comedic stars are allowed to kind of play at the same time. That's how Hollywood has kind of had it. This particular class that he's talking about and referring to, everybody got on. And they all had that moment of comedic stardom on stage and off the stage, whether it was television and film or one or the other. But those that had did it and got to do both, that list is extremely small, man. And you're on that list, dude. Kudos to you. I appreciate you. I am forever a fan, and I can't wait to see you when you do get the year 40. And I got to fucking know about it now, because I got to be in the goddamn house if you are performing somewhere, knowing what the hell that means, man. I genuinely thank you for giving me the time, man, and more importantly, letting us pick your goddamn mind. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Comedy Gold Mines. You know what we do here. Get inside the minds of brilliant comedians. Today, what was no different, Eddie Griffin. Thank you, dude.
Thank you, Kevin. Thank you, brother.
Blessings to you, your family. Good luck to your son. I can't wait to see him at the top. When that time comes, the world will know. And, man, kudos and shout out to your wife. Keeping a smile on your goddamn face. Your skin look good. You look fucking healthy.
That's right.
And that's because there ain't no negativity around in the shows, brother. If you're in Vegas, check my guy out.
Thank you, Kevin. I love you, brother.
Comedy Gold Mines is a Sirius XM and LOL audio production. Executive produced by Kevin Hart, Ty Randolph, and Eric Weil. With Tastemakers Media, Emil Garner, and Ian McDonald.